I'll speak in English apparently, because I guess this you're much more comfortable in that language, and I guess everybody else here.
Ouais, mais j'aime pas avoir ça dans l'oreille.
So I'll therefore do my little presentation in that language. Thanks to the organizers, of course, for inviting me. I appreciate being here. And really what I'm going to try and develop this afternoon is some sense of why, this is going to sound a bit funny, but some sense of why what's happening in the free source code and the free software movement is so very, and I guess I mustn't go too far from this machine, so important in much wider ways in our society. I'd like to look at two different sort of things, which quickly we'll turn around two basic themes. The first theme is really the question of, and you've heard already quite a bit about it from Philippe, it's the question of infrastructure. And the other one is the question of individualism, how it is being reshaped in this very moment in history. So let's start a little bit, if you want, with the infrastructural approach. When the software, the free software movement began, many people, and I've talked to Jacques Gélina about that once for a long time, many people were thinking that really the whole point of that was really to create some very fundamental pieces of the puzzle, the computer puzzle, so as to ensure some sort of stable, basic, accessible platform for everybody. In effect, the reason why big companies recently have moved into the arena of free source code or free software is really based on the idea that if they don't do that, they are not able to compete effectively with the great 800-pound gorilla that we all know in the computer field, namely Microsoft. And because of that, you see companies like particularly IBM changing completely their strategies and developing an active participation inside the free software movement, because I think they had all read the results of events such as the losing competition of a proprietary software such as WordPerfect against a piece of software like Microsoft Word. And you know essentially why this was the case. I mean, WordPerfect, the companies, the various companies that have owned WordPerfect, eventually developed attitudes really quickly developed the perception that they could never get the full information and they could never get it fast enough to really compete with the Word, Microsoft Word teams at Redmond. So from that sort of perception that you cannot compete with this 800-pound gorilla, and the perception that you can create some basic, very basic sort of platform on which you can recreate forms of competition that would obey more what the Anglophone world calls the level playing field that we were talking about in a different context this morning with Philippe, emerged, I think, this whole notion of infrastructural conceptualization. In effect, what people were trying to do is, what should we really build in order to create something that is infrastructural? And when we build something infrastructural, what are we really trying to achieve? Now, I've already put forward one very important dimension of this particular infrastructural conceptualization. It is that everybody has an equal access to it, a complete, full, and just as easy access to it as anybody else. But the second question that emerged rather quickly is that, well, how far should the infrastructure extend? What kind of infrastructure do we want to build? And the basic approach to this whole question was, in a sense, what you might call a fixed vision on the whole thing. You might say, in effect, that when Torvalds began in 91, playing with the idea of recreating something like a Unix kernel without using the Unix code, that in effect he was going to solve this notion of infrastructure once and for all in a fixed way. You might say that even before before Torvalds, when Stallman wanted to do this whole system of a completely open operating system for computers, he had, in effect, with the accompanying software and the equivalent of what was going to become the kernel, a vision of what the infrastructure was. And all these, let's say, approaches to the notion of infrastructures, were perfectly defensible. They were quite legitimate, quite logical, in fact. The point, though, is that as time went on, and this was what really transpired when I did that discussion with my friend Gélina, as time passed on, people like Jacques himself, who was doing his bit, as you know, programming Linux Conf and that sort of thing, they were suddenly seeing younger people coming around and saying, why shouldn't I do image processing software? Why shouldn't I do word processing? Why shouldn't I do, and as we know, little by little, practically, every domain has been progressively and gradually invaded. And at that point, you say to yourself, well, is all of computer science and all software infrastructural by nature? Or is there something in there that really ought to be there should be a limit on it? My answer to that is that it's neither, actually. I think what we are really seeing there is essentially a dynamic system that is beginning to be set up. I'm going to try and solve this technical problem. And what's the matter?
Perfect.
Okay, very good. That way I've got three hands now. I can really gesticulate. Right. And and you know, even when they speak English, French-speaking people like to use their hands, but it's I'll stop that. The question, therefore, is not to try and determine a priori where would be an infrastructural dimension to the whole question. The question is not to say contrary-wise that everything is infrastructure. The question is really going to be the whole element of where should we, how should we negotiate that limit? And that's, it's going to be the first thesis I'm going to be advancing. In effect, what I'm saying there is that while proprietary forces are at work to try and constrain and decrease and diminish what could be considered as some sort of publicly accessible, perhaps public domain or related, like Philippe, I will use the sort of wide notion of public domain that you were addressing. Well, there is a definite thrust pushing in that direction of constraining, reducing, eroding that domain which is accessible to all. Contrarywise, has emerged an equilibrating force which is trying to expand and open up the whole thing. It's like two competing chemical reactions, in effect. And there are speeds of reaction now taking place, which I think are much more important to look at than to try and define what might be an infrastructure of computer science or a legitimate definition of a boundary between the public domain and the proprietary domains. So that, in effect, what we are seeing now that the demonstration has been done that a way of producing software in a new way, and that will be part of my second part of my presentation, is workable. Once it has been demonstrated that not only is the production possible and, in fact, quite efficient, one is also discovering that the number of kinds of software that could be made, in effect, into public domain type, GPL type forms of software is unlimited. It is, in fact, only limited by the ability by the proprietary forces to try and maintain their own territory and expand it to their own advantage. Now, the interesting thing is that I think as time goes on, and despite all the legal and all the kinds of maneuverings that we see around us taking place, I think that time is on our side, if I may say this thing, I think we are all on the same side in this room, at least I hope so. I don't know how many spies there are here, but I'll do as if there were no spies in this room. Hello, Microsoft spy, whoever you may be, it's the Microsoft, right? Okay, so the time is on our side because as things move on, we see clearly that sector after sector is becoming more developed, more viable, the quality increases, and sooner or later more and more organizations are seeing that there are many advantages to using these products because precisely they offer them the four, well, I'm not going to go through the usual sort of mantra about free software, but you know how we can control it, you can pinpoint the usability to your own needs, whatever, and everything. You know all that better than I do. What I'm seeing right now as all these series of approach of maneuvers by the companies to try and maintain the territory, to extend the territory, which are based partially on technology but much more on legal things, appears to me more and more as something similar to what the French know as in their history as the réaction nobiliaire. That is, right before the French Revolution, as the economic situation was slowly shifting to a different ground, where the source of wealth in feudal countries was slowly being eroded by new forms of wealth creation, which was based to modern liberalism, capitalism, and the like. You all know that as well as I do. At one point, really finding themselves on the verge of collapse, in a sense, the noble class tried to revitalize its strength by, of course, re-implementing old laws and applying them as strenuously as possible. I think the extensions of the copyright laws, the development of these kinds of strategies to try and bring about greater revenues for these companies and greater control, as Philippe again very rightly pointed out a minute ago, are exactly that sort of phase. So that's why perhaps I'm a bit more optimistic than you are, Philippe, because I see that over a fairly long period of time, and I see that meanwhile the technology is really working on our sides, both in terms of the development of new software and also in the way people appropriate these technologies to do things which are not always legal, but at the same time becoming more and more socially potent, socially effective. This is also a thought which to me is very, very much supported by, and this is what Frédéric had asked me to deal with a little bit, with, in effect, precedents in the history of print. And that's where I think that, again, we can take some comfort in seeing what's happening right now. I don't know if you remember or not how Francis I, the French king, again, reacted to the coming of printing into France. But one of his most intelligent, and being ironic, reactions was to forbid printing in the kingdom for 3 years. Now, when he did that, which was, he was scared by it. He was scared by it for a number of reasons. He couldn't control the circulation of documents anymore. He couldn't control those new professions emerging. He couldn't control anything at all. I mean, he was seeing all these guys. I mean, they were the geeks of the time, you might call them. Just running around with these new strange machines, and you saw these strange alliances between people that you had never seen talking to each other before, such as metallurgists and humanists. I mean, we have the same difficulties on there when you see geeks talking to people like me, for example. But the social distances, luckily, are a bit less nowadays than they were in the Renaissance. Nonetheless, Francis I had the feeling that his kingdom was going every which way because, in a sense, the new technology was destroying the traditional ways of controlling, for example, the production, storage, and circulation of documents. Well, when he forbade for 3 years printing in France, what happened? Imagine. Well, those who were doing printing in France went elsewhere to do it, first point. So he was losing all the technical skill. All the geeks were going out, So you're losing that thing, and that's not very good for the future of the country. Even Francis I realized that. The second thing was that if you forbid the printed book in your kingdom, then you really have no control over it, because it comes in clandestinely through the borders, and this clandestine carrying of books over the border was really underground, and that really was far more subversive than having a system of controls in place. And the king, in effect, after a while, realized that there were some important gains to be made by actually accepting the new technology and trying to control it as much as possible. The difference between the print and the present world is that, unlike our present technologies, print had, for the powers that be, a very important, let's say, protective belt, so to speak, which was that the investment to produce text with a press were always fairly high. So you knew that only a few people could get involved into printing, and because of that, you could control those people. And that's exactly what happened over the next two or three centuries. The profession was controlled very effectively. It was, in fact, tied to families. The provincial forms of printing were destroyed so that most of the printers were where they were easiest to control and watch, namely Paris. And in that fashion, the kingly powers of France, following in that recipes that were already put in place in other countries in Europe, were quite successful in not only constraining and controlling that technology, but in fact leaning on it to do their own stuff, like spreading their laws and, of course, creating their ways of spreading the news and their visions of the world and so on and so forth. You know. So there are limited comparisons that can be made that, in a sense, show that the world of print can help us understand why it is similar to our world, and also a number of points which shows that it was not entirely the same sort of thing. My general argument is that, to the extent that the world of print is generally recognized as, despite all that control, to have been a period or coinciding with a period of great expansion in the variety of ideas circulating, the kinds of theses being defended and attacked and so on, let's say the intensity of the debates in European societies that emerge with print, to the extent that despite all these controls, all that happened, and to the extent that presently the digital technologies appear to me far less controllable than the old print technologies, I would say, and we can discuss about that since I see a few heads nodding negatively, I would say that the future looks fairly hopeful. The future looks fairly interesting in these regards. We may move into, indeed, a world where a lot more will be available, possible, with far less constraints than before, which may not be a better world for that matter. You know, I mean, we know also what happens when people get too easy an access to publication possibilities. We all know about the debates about negationists and all these kinds of things. So I'm not saying that having an easier way to get into the production of whatever is a sure ticket to paradise or utopia. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying the situation is probably going to evolve in that general direction, which will bring with it new and quite interesting and not always very pleasant consequences. So we've got to be very careful about how we support these questions of freedom and non-freedom, because they can lead to very, very different forms of societies, which behind the appearances of very positive terms like freedom can lead to extremely difficult situations. I just want to as an example to say, for example, the quick emergence of relatively cheap and ever cheaper digital cameras, and the greater and greater availability of even professional digital movie cameras, which in fact can lead us to believe that within a few years you could have Linux-like construction of movies, CVS-like, with bits of events and whatever, and just built together and so on and so forth. would in fact be the effect of this sort of thing, and could, if it worked beautifully enough, exactly as Linux has worked, could make Hollywood irrelevant. I mean, these are the kinds of prospects we can, I mean, this is, I'm not talking next year or even next 10 or 20 years, but you could imagine that very, very easily in the future. It could also bring about some very horrible forms of art, you know. I mean, it could be manipulated in some very, very difficult things. And that's why I was saying earlier in that discussion period in the previous paper, how what's going to be very important is the kinds of communities that are going to shepherd, steward these kinds of processes, because it's really those communities that are going to be the, let's say, the wardens, the protectors, the supports for certain kinds of values. And you're going to see conflicting values appearing through these communities, big community fights, which will be international, very diaspora-like, totally transborder, very difficult to control by law, because laws are always territorial. So you're going to have these kinds of situations which are both very hopeful, very open, and yet at the same time can be extremely, extremely, let's say, threatening in some kinds of contexts. In passing, in the same way that the printed world led to a number of consequences that we are so familiar with that we think that they are very important, these concepts may well dissolve and gradually fade into oblivion in the next half century. One that seems to me a very prime candidate to future oblivion is one we've talked a lot this afternoon. It's the concept of author. Concept of author, which of course took its culminating point in the Romantic period, is a concept which has shaped a whole series of laws, and the laws may be at one point trying to grasp an object which essentially will have disappeared from our societies. Why? Think again of Linux. Linux is tons and tons of code, and in there, you've got some people who have just done a few lines of code, and others who have done hundreds and thousands of lines of code, all is signed normally. But who is the author of Linux, really, nowadays? It's a process. It's a way of generating code. But and all the people that have been involved in the generation of code can be retraced. But you cannot say that any one of them is an author any more than you can say that when you do a huge experiment at CERN, and you have 700 physicists, including the floor sweeper, named in the article, which sometimes is shorter than the list of authors. This has happened at least once in the history of science. You cannot say that these people are authors in the traditional romantic form of the term. I mean, this has nothing to do with creativity as it was then. It's a process. We're really talking about the process and the dynamics of things. So we may see the gradual fading out of the word author, as in fact we've already seen it in movies. You know, we still speak about the director and all that in movies as a kind of equivalent of an author, but no one gets taken in unless you've been really brainwashed by Cahiers du Cinéma when you were about 20 in the 60s, you know, as I was. But I have been able to unwash my brain about that. So that's why I'm the great unwashed, by the way. And that's a bad pun. Sorry about that. the whole what I'm trying to say is that this whole battle of creating infrastructure, limits between the public domain and the proprietary domain, is going to be leaning on a series of processes and dynamics, which not only, as I've said, are going to favor the public sort of domain in many, many ways, the access to production for many, but at the same time is going to put into question a number of very important elements of the stability of our present culture, which relies on things like authors, mediation, you go through a term which is widely offered, and so on. We're going to have to become ever more critical ourselves individually in order to be able to confront and face in a rational and logical way a series of information which actually can be extraordinarily misleading and manipulative in the future. So that would be the first part of my presentation this afternoon. Let's not talk about infrastructure as a thing, let's talk it again as a process with a moving boundary. Let's think of it as a competing struggle between two chemical reactions going contrary-wise. And let's also think of all that as a series of changes which are going also to affect the very existence of some very, very important entities that shape presently, still shape presently our culture and yet may not in the future. We're watching, I think, a deep cultural mutation in this kind of competing reaction model that I'm trying to propose to you. The second part of my presentation is really the question of, you know, what can be learned from the whole question of production of software the way the free software has demonstrated. What can be learned from that? Well, the first thing is that, of course, the model did not emerge there. Free software did not invent the way it produces itself. It's not in free software that this thing was first observed. Actually, one might say, I'm not even sure there it was the first one, but it's sufficiently old and sufficiently famous to mention it. Actually, I would, as a first hypothesis, and I'm ready to be corrected on that point, is that it really emerged in the so-called scientific revolution period, when scientists, that is, natural philosophers, as they were called at the time, in the 17th century, in particular in Western Europe, began to invent not the idea that they had to study nature or things like that. People have been studying nature forever, but decided that they were going to create a system of communication to bring about a way of checking with each other who was really doing good work and who was really moving forward, in a sense, on this or that question. Incidentally and amusingly, the whole notion of the Republic of Science as it was developed, and I'll talk more tomorrow about that particular question, would not have been possible without postal systems. And it's thanks to the post office developing in Europe that from courts to courts, people were sending documents, and essentially the system was being pirated by the Republic of Letters and Republic of Science. People were just adding a few more envelopes in the satchels, and they were sending stuff in a very funny way. It was like, you see, I've done this great thing, and I'm sending the news to you, not because I trust you. In fact, I don't trust you at all. And you're my competitor, and I hate you. I hate your guts, actually, because, you know, you claim you're better than I, and I know I'm better than you. I mean, we all know that. And just to make sure that you cannot steal my idea, I've sent it to you, but I've sent it to a lot of people. So if you dare claim that this idea is yours, you're going to look stupid. You know, and this was the basic. I mean, this is what's kind of amusing in this whole idea, that science was really based on a very, very hard-nosed notion of the best way for me to own my ideas is by giving them away publicly to enough people that, in effect, that idea could not be taken away from me anymore because I'd have witnesses all over Europe. Essentially, what you do is force your competitor into being your witness, which is very uncomfortable, you know, but very clever. Very clever. In fact, so clever, we're still doing it on a big scale. Because meanwhile, at first, all this was done directly, and then there were some routers in the Republic of Science, guys who were writing letters a lot to others and repeating the news from the, you know, from one to the other. In France, the Father Mersenne, a friend of Descartes, was well known for that. Obviously, had a tremendous wrist to write lots of letters. And Oldenburg in Britain, the Royal Society, was doing similar things. Leibniz, as you probably know, was an astounding writer, letter writer, and so on and so forth. Some of these guys, I call them the routers of the Republic of Science, if you consider that the postal system was the internet of the time. And you have the basics of that, but even those routers were crumbling under the weight of the not enough bandwidth, not enough risk. So what they decided was to marshal the local technology that was available and adapt it to the needs. And that was, of course, using print, and that was inventing the scientific journal. And the journal was really a mechanization of the letter. And in fact, you could, you know, just print the articles, and then you just dispatch them around Europe to 300, 400, 500 copies. And then you were really sure that the thing was not being stolen away from you because at that point, you had 300, 400, 500 witnesses all across the continent. So once you have this picture in mind, what you notice is that, the free source code, the free software movement has done exactly the same sort of thing. When people write code, they publish it, essentially. And by publishing it, they know that that part of the code will be retained and remembered attached to that particular person. Some of it is done very generously with very little concern about that, but other parts are not done that way. And the point is to create what sociologists generally call symbolic capital. You find these people producing code because you get reputation, authority, prestige by being known to have created that really nifty patch in that particular part of the software in the community that is concerned about that. It's about the same as when you do that really nifty solving of a differential equation to get this kind of hydrodynamic problem that had never been solved before and known, of course, in a very small circle of specialists. It's the same sort of thing. So that you have to ask yourself, who is that kind of individual? What sort of individual is it? And my answer to that takes a form which sounds a bit pedant, but I think it's useful to do it that way. I call that a form of individualism. And this form of individualism, I qualify it, characterize it as phonemic, to base it on the notion of the concept of phoneme in linguistics. Now, phonemes are very interesting entities because when you define the basic sounds of a language, there is one very interesting problem you have to solve, which is people can speak the same language with extremely varied accents. And the proof is that you understand me despite my French. And you have to say to yourself, how can I understand that person? Although that person, if I were to make a very, very systematic analysis of what the sound O or U and so on in that is not pronounced the same way as anybody else's. Why? How does that work? And the great invention of the phoneme by Saussure, the Swiss linguist at the end of the 19th century, was to invent really what I call the third way to describe the world. I mean, there are only three ways to describe the universe. Sorry, people. Don't know anymore. If you do, tell me. I would be interested. You have the sort of, you know, on up, the bricks, and you keep piling them up, atomism and all that. That's one way. You've got the other way, which has fallen a bit into disrepute recently, but we used to be quite popular. You've got the great whole, you know, God, whatever, divinity, and then the emanations stemming out of that. We are all emanations from God, and then there are angels on top of us coming closer to God and so on and so on. That were the only two ways we had until the end of the 19th century. Saussure said, well, there might be a third way of doing it, which is, imagine that we had like atoms, but instead of describing these atoms by a series of qualities, which would be their predicates, in effect, and this atom of iron has so much density, and so on and so forth, if I said, well, it differs from lead this way, it differs from copper this way, and so on and so forth. It's kind of funny, actually, because it might be able to define in a new way what isotopes are like, but I'll leave that to those more curious about those questions in this crowd, small crowd. So he said that the sound in the language really exists exactly that way. We in most languages in Europe, for example, when we hear B, we distinguish it from V, except the Spaniards, of course, who end up doing a and the kind of in-between thing. I hope there are no Spanish-speaking people here, but, I had this friend named Eve, and, I would pronounce it Eve, and she'd say, no, it's Eve. And, so I had to try and figure out how to do it in between and sort of let it go with my lips going completely like that, mushy, and then apparently I was doing it right. So that is by confusing the two phonemes for the Frenchman into one phoneme for the Spaniards. Now, that means that you have a number of separate entities, like atoms, but they only exist to the extent that they can distinguish themselves from similar entities. It's like a peer system in which you exist only to the extent that you're different from the others. Think of what we are as individuals in a society. We only exist, actually, to the extent that people recognize something in our difference, which is kind of interesting to them. If there is too much difference, we're crazy. So we're out and put into an asylum or ignored. If we are too similar, we're boring, right? So we don't exist anymore either. I mean, it's probably the greatest problem for twin brothers and sisters, real twins, is that they're so similar that they have to be terribly boring to each other, or fuse, have a kind of fusion fantasy. And the phoneme sort of creates this kind of very interesting tension between existence through resemblance and yet distinction. And in fact, again, the same sociologist who created the term symbolic capital, Bourdieu, also was talking about the way people exist through distinction. And it may not be a pure quirk of language that we give distinctions to people that do interesting things in society. There is this sort of, linguistic wisdom in this notion of distinction. Now, when you create code in Linux, when you create code in GIMP, when you create code in KDE or whatever, what are you doing? You're achieving existence through recognizable distinction. You're putting yourself into a community. You are cooperating, but you're cooperating in a way that you don't want to dissolve yourself into the community. You want to animate the community by being better than most of the people around in that little nifty patch you're doing, or that little nifty extension you're doing. You're participating in that group to the extent that that group, in a sense, recognizes that you exist in that group. And the whole thing is moving in that way. At least that would be my contention and my thesis. I'm arguing that this whole motion, this whole dynamics that emerged with science, and now it seems to be extending to new walks of life. It has extended through authorship. For an author is really a distinctive individual, again, very phonemic. Since there are many French-speaking people in this room, think of Huysmans' relationship to Zola. I mean, he first trying to be a Zola 2.0. It doesn't work too well for his career. So he decides to be anti-Zola, and he goes completely berserk in a different direction and creates things exactly in reverse of Zola. Instead of, in fact, A Rebours and Là-bas are really like, you know, parodies of inverse Zola. That is to say, instead of really going into the street, you hear them through thick walls in one of these novels, as barely being perceptible. And of course, as a kind of wink to Zola, saying, while you'd be in the street describing the demonstration in favor of General Boulanger, I'm going to describe those crazy people in a church tower describing things like Gilles de Rais' trial and the theology of bells. You know, these are the kinds of way of creating distinctiveness, which authors use as well. And then you see that extending to every walk of science, every walk of new sciences, and you see, in fact, this kind of very funny merging of science and writing and computer science coding, which, again, feeds into this notion of distinctive, phonemic, for lack of a better word, individualism. It's been a long time in our society, I would argue, that we've been trying to figure out a way to move out precisely from either collectivism or rabid individualism. It's been a long time that we've been trying to find a third way, and some of these third ways, as you know, have been pretty dire. I mean, fascism, some forms of communism, and so on. Not very funny third ways. Yet the question of a third way still hangs in front of our noses, I think. And it may be that the very practice that we see again restored and developed in the free software movement is nothing but, you might say, the untheorized precursor to a theory of individualism that at last might be the worthwhile, the valuable theory of individualism we've been looking for a long time. So if you put together what I've been trying to say this afternoon, on the one hand, not a static vision of the infrastructure that you defend like a fortress against the encroachment of of companies, but rather as a competing dynamics of competing chemical reactions, to use my metaphor. And if you add to that that on one side of these chemical reactions, you really have the full strength and the whole dynamism of what I call phonemic individualism, I think we're coming into a very fascinating world. And I'd like to leave you with that this afternoon. Thank you.
Et bien sûr, je réponds aux questions.
Dawkins kind of stuff. Yeah. Well, I know of it. I'm not a specialist of that. Let me put it to very, very quickly. I would say that what you just adumbrated very quickly would be the macro side of what I was describing from a micro vision. That is, as since I was looking at how to redefine some form of individualism and the form of basic actor kind of entity in the final part of my presentation, I would argue that this probably fits more into a micro kind of approach, if I use the economics kind of way of looking at things. And you're looking at it more from the macro sort of thing, but they're not incompatible, far from it. They're very, 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 very complementary. I think these are metaphors in any case, which is exactly the role of metaphors, which can stimulate our investigation of all these phenomena. Metaphors are exactly meant for that purpose, and that's why I'm proposing them, and I think your response is just goes in the same direction. Yeah. I've never believed in technology being in itself and of itself the key to human happiness, for example, or to the best way to organize societies. I have always conceived all this as being all has to be subsumed under some sort of value system, volition system, societal organization to express all these values and visions and all that. And there is absolutely no insurance that it will end this way or that way. In fact, one may argue that the only thing that's sure is that my competing reactions that I was describing this afternoon could be sort of transposed and metaphorically, again, metaphor over metaphor, could be applied to practically all these kinds of developments. And one can say that you can also predict that those two competing equations, or rather reactions, well, to some extent, always be very close in effectiveness to each other. It's a kind of marginal game, you know, and which makes it all the more important for every one of us who have what I might call then an ethical vision of the world. And again, there I think I'm very close to what Philippe says in other words in his conferences, have to think of putting their weight this way or that way, precisely because it is constantly a kind of self-re-equilibrating system with very slight temporary advantages on one side or the other. And remember that what I said, I hope for the future, but if, for example, you go into a world in which, say, everybody can really publish whatever, imagine the whole question of control would have been licked. and it's really individuals forever. I'm not sure that individuals without a certain measure of control is such a wonderful utopia. You see? That's exactly my point. Unless the libertarians, for example, who think that by just pushing the mantra of ever more individualism, ever more happiness, I think are going into a war.
Yeah.
Well, I think, again, it's like the notion of individual, the notion of author. I think the whole question of how you are anonymous is going to define itself differently as time goes on. I mean, we have a certain way of looking at our anonymity and our privacy and our sphere, let's say our sort of intimacy sphere, which have changed enormously over time. I mean, anybody reading any history of modesty, for example, you know, even in Western societies over the last 6 centuries, it's completely, you know, completely flabbergasted by the great changes in that. So I expect that our whole notion of anonymity may change enormously with time. We've already lived through things like that, which help us think about the future. We were just talking, I think, Philippe and I today about how the civic numbers appeared in cities. You know, why do you have numbers in street for on your house? The origin came with the plagues. When the plagues, you know, rolled all over Europe, the only defense was separation, quarantine. And just to make sure that you knew what you're talking about in those zones of the city, you started describing not only the streets, that had been done before, but each house had to be pinpointed, and then civic numbers appear. In Japan, there are no civic numbers, by the way, you know, which makes it for a bit of a mess when you want to walk around in Japan and find things. But they have a greater sense of anonymity because of that. The control over the population is done through other kinds of mechanisms. So again, I mean, you have to do this contrasted sort of observation of different societies and see how control and anonymity are working together to say, well, if we add all these new tools which allow to trace me better, but at the same time allow me to create false identities all the time, again, my marginal kind of vision of things sort of racing with each other, we're going to end up with different visions of anonymity, obviously. A metaphor.
And actually, I'm not pessimistic. For example, if I gave the impression that I was pessimistic about the fate of the side of a chemical reaction, which is the side of the cooperation and exchange, it was not really representative of my thinking, because actually, I don't feel lies in its disparition in any manner. I think the real risk lies more in how much energy would be spent in
sure.
The blast between the two
sure.
Sides. But there is one side on which I'm more optimistic, apparently, than you, in the sense
good.
That, in the sense that it's the side of critical perception, because basically, if I understand correctly what you said about what would be a potential risk of a world with too much freedom in emission. Okay. Of course, we know one needs, if we have many sources of information, if we have fast propagation, if we have speed, fast but also wide propagation, we need strong critical perception.
Right.
There, I would say, they are quickly maturing.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
In the sense that if you look, for example, what happened for books, where with the notion of what is called now the critical apparatus, footnotes, comments, and introduction, etc.,
right.
Was very slow and relatively painful process.
Yeah.
Well, I see this critical reception, and I have, for me, your book is very pleasurable, just for the paper on the individual and the collective information communities. And so we're trying to explore exactly this confrontation and the trying to invent a new type of middle ground, which is actually a relation. I'm describing it more as a relationship between the individual and the collective. And there, I believe, there is an extraordinary invention in things like Slashdot, Wikipedia, in things like the copy of various PHP or speak websites. But the problem, this is one more reason for wanting the right to support and reuse. Because if we want critical reception, the big problem we have is there are media for which there are no critical reception.
Absolutely.
And these media are very powerful.
No, I agree.
Television is one of them. It's not the only one, but television is the most.
Although what's happening, and I think again, I mean, this is a very funny development. It's still very much at the beginning because the bandwidth issue is still present and limits what can be done. But when I see what my youngest son, who's probably about the age of most people in this room, is doing with bandwidth and big. Hard disks and the like, I see it very easily happening in the next few years. People like him and even younger people picking up bits of television off the broadcast on the cable, storing it, making a series of comments, visual and criticisms and all that, and then reshipping that around the network, saying this was a piece of crap. Imagine someone right now just doing the work of catching up every time Bush and Blair said there are weapons of mass destruction, as the joke says, but I won't. It's mass destruction, actually, of course.
But of course, but we will be shooting the first day, so be prepared to defend us.
Sure. Well, it depends. I mean, in the States, you have the right of parody, you have the right of fair use. So you could take short elements of Bush and the like speaking and just sending it on with comments that you do otherwise, or you just juxtapose them and just say, no comment. And the person who looks so stupid by all the incoherences and the contradictions that I think anybody then say, I think I've been had there. Now, I don't know who was first of you two, so. Sure.
I mean, Napster, the original, I mean, even the protocol says it's MP3s only. But if you look at what's available.
Oh, no, sure, with Freenet and all that, and Nutella,
If a television show comes out in Japan, an animated show, you can often within a week have a translation in the United States.
Mm.
But back to audio, this sort of remixing that you're saying is already happening.
Yeah.
If you look on the archives of the Boing Boing weblog, there was something with Jack Valenti, who's the president of the Motion Picture Association of America. Where they remixed one of his speeches, and the end result was very funny. I've also seen it with both. So I think if we're not doing it with audio, then within a few years we're going to be able to do it with video.
Absolutely, yeah.
The problem is that unlike text content, it's a lot harder to reply in the same medium. Most people.
I would say the contrary in the future, for the simple reason that, as Franklin used to say in the 18th century in the States, I wish everybody had a printing press. Now we all have a digital press.
That's
good for text. I'm talking about images and all that. We're having all that. We have GIMP, we have digital cameras, people are buying video camcorders, and are doing all sorts of wonderful mixings of that. You've got studio software which allows you to remix and do whatever. No, on the contrary.
But it's harder if you are going to insert genuinely new elements. For instance, your special effects are quite unlikely to ever be able to match anything that even a small...
Trust it to some kid in somewhere. who is going to blast the world out by just finding, you know, one way of doing it, and the whole of Hollywood is going to look at that, go by, and say, what the hell is happening here? Just watch it. You know, it's been happening a lot already. I mean, after all, remember the age of Torvalds when it started? Oh, yeah. Especially with morphing software and so on. And because this availability is going to become more and more prevalent, you're going to see a lot of people developing the right tools to be able to play with that more and more. And, you know, it's going to become extraordinarily funny in 10 years down the line, but then we'll have to be terribly critical, because where is the truth? What do these images represent? Do they represent anything at all? Are they just algorithms? You know, it will be very difficult to decide. And that's where the communities are going to be coming back very stronger, because it's only through discussions among people, diasporas of ideas, that the real life of the mind will take place, not through the supports. It's funny, we're getting...
Right. What we are doing now.
Yeah, right. More important, because I can't, unless you've been cloned, I cannot think that you're virtual right now. If you've been cloned, I don't know how to. Except you've got to add one element to what you're saying. You're perfectly right, I think. Oh, sorry.
So to add to your point regarding communities and self-building communities, the problem is that if you add control to this, that you give people the power to lock the information and to prevent people from starting a new movement in case the one goes mad, then you are in trouble.
Mm. Can have dire consequences.
You start from zero again with the bees or something like that. But I mean, we have a problem with the power that we have.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, we've been talking about what technically makes possible new forms of media or criticism or with audio or video and things like that. But one aspect is missing, except from what you just said before, is you've got to have access to main.
Sure. For a while.
Your own alternative media will it depends on the dynamics. I mean, some of those caricature pictures have been all around the internet, but some are don't have that sense. And those dynamics of what makes it mainstream or remaining underground are still to be made evolving. And what you said about the newspapers is, you know, it's technically possible to have collaboratively edited newspapers for
would say the one thing that's happening definitely is a complexifying, what you might call, again a metaphor, a complexifying ecology of media. I mean, where you used to have print, then the radio came on, then television, then the movies alongside a bit earlier, and then now we have the internet, and you know, and other things will probably emerge sooner or later. The internet itself is like a metamedia, because it's really a framework within which you can subsume practically every other media and invent new forms of media. So, you know, we're going to see a proliferation of media, with some of them, of course, trying to fit the bill that powers that be would like to see, you know, implemented, but others not. And again, the equilibria that are going to emerge out of that are going to become, I cannot predict that. I mean, my crystal ball is very muddy. But the point is that the ecology is complexifying, and therefore the combinations are going to become richer and more interesting as time goes on, it seems to.
No,
of course not.
They are, but the problem is to be able to install a meaningful relationship between cooperative media or even completely distributed expression like weblogs towards the media. But I would like to add one element, let's say, because I'm a technologist, but also I was for a long time a funder of technological innovation. Must not take technology as an exogenous variable. I mean, technology is in the making.
Sure.
And it is extremely oriented,
sure,
in its development, not so much directly by choosing technology, but by which framework,
sure,
of directions and rules of procedures,
sure,
and rights do you put around. And what I have witnessed in the past 5 years in terms of evolution of this orientation is quite scary, honestly. Because there was a first, I mean, there was something which was always there, is that we have invested. I mean, I am one of the founder of content processing of video and content processing of music. And what I have seen is it's still nowhere except audimetry,
where,
I mean, my voice are used by people to produce storyboards where people can see where someone is at an advertising, and they are still not available to get to be more critical or more productive. But well, that's you can say is the normal environmental effect. But what I have seen more recently is a huge investment in the post-September 11th, a total redefining of the goals of technology, of things like swarming, surveillance, etc. And where basically I think they are, I have received scores of Dr. Polamour and great people, you know, the heads of Cadence there, I think we need criticism towards technology,
sure,
not
sure,
only criticism towards content. We need an ability to say, well, this is, we have it for TCPA, but thanks to mediators like Ross Anderson, but we need it for technology more globally.
No, I agree.
Last question here, and after we have to close the session because we have a rendezvous for the lunch.
Dinner.
I've been told 7 just at the desk,
but
because they didn't know what. Okay. Let's say 6. Anyway,
you can go
to
the question outside. Last question.
A little comment on the video part. Most people aren't aware, but it's starting to happen today. There are. I have a guy I knew recently who has a. He's recording something like 10 CDs of video every day, so that's a nice average. The other thing about communities, I've worked for several years now the expression is going out of use, talking about the global village.
No, I'm not hearing about that. But
yes. No, what I always thought that what was going to happen is a little different, and I think that's what we are seeing now. It's not a global village, it's global villages, where you have communities, not geographically bounded,
no,
but more bounded by ideas and things
affinity
in common.
Affinity bound.